particularly difficult thrust was that sweat that dampened his brow.
Oversweep, crane and circle, three and four and swipe.
She watched in amazement as the tip of her sword slashed across Torn's leather jerkin. Although it only made a long cut in the leather, his face blanched, as if it had been his own flesh.
Who are you?
Torn panted, his eyes wide in fear.
Two and three and raven sweep redoubled.
The move threw Torn against a tree, his arms and sword tangling in the evergreen boughs.
Butcher's block, 1, 2, 3.
Torn barely avoided being chopped in three. Each swing of the sword caused the pain of arrows in her back to twinge, and the bleeding to start anew.
Who are you?
Torn demanded again.
Burn, brooch, burn. By the flying horse, burn.
Torn screamed. He groped with his free hand for the brooch on his cloak. He grasped it, but jerked his fingers away with a cry. The distraction was enough.
Ice slide, now!
The blade ran through Torn's jerkin and out through his back, impaling him to the trunk of the tree. His limbs jerked and flailed. Kerrigan's nostrils flared with the metallic scent of fresh blood.
Who are you?
This time it came as a whisper, barely heard over his raspy breaths. A voice that was Kerrigan's spoke words that were not her own.
I am a Green Rider and Swordmaster Initiate. You are spared Savril's fate, traitor.
The hand that held the hilt twisted the sword, and Torn's eyes rolled into the back of his head. The presence within her turned to Jindara and reached for her dagger.
Stop!
Kerrigan struggled to expel the presence from her, but it was like trying to disgorge her own guts.
Leave me.
The presence drained from her, and she sighed as warmth flooded through her body again. Freyan Kobelbay stood before her.
I saved your life, he said. She is a traitor and must die.
It is for me to decide, Kerrigan said, if she should die.
She gazed at Jindara lying on her back, neck naked to any blade she might draw across it. The blood was drying on the weapon's face, but she breathed normally and looked to be asleep. Kerrigan remembered when Jindara made Torn let her wear her greatcoat against the cold rain. Jindara had let her keep her hidden cache of food and had never told Torn about it. She knew Jindara would have killed Garoti to keep him from hurting her. Freyan Kobelbay's form flickered once.
You must kill her.
You kill her.
I cannot, unless I enter.
I won't allow that.
Kerrigan clenched and unclenched her hands at her sides.
I will not be used.
I saved your life.
The night's events started to catch up with her. Her body trembled, and she felt cold all over again. The idea of someone else controlling her affairs infuriated and terrified her.
It seems to me you set me on this course in the first place, you and that brooch.
Freyan Kobelbay dimmed and flickered.
No, not I. You were called.
He looked up at the sky, then walked away, vanishing completely in the dark. But his voice lingered like an echo.
You were called.
Kerrigan sighed, feeling lightheaded from the whole experience. She wanted to get away from the carnage as soon as she could, Garoti's crushed face and Torn's impaled body. But she needed the brooch back, too. Jindara murmured incomprehensibly and twitched on the ground. She would have to be quick. Torn was pinned to the tree like a cadaverous scarecrow, his arms snagged at odd angles among the evergreen branches. The brooch clung by a thread to his cloak. With a shudder, she plucked it away. It had burned a hole right through his cloak and jerkin, and had branded a red shadow of the winged horse on his flesh. The Berry sisters had been right, in a sense. The brooch would tolerate no others to handle it, except Green Riders. It had merely waited for the most advantageous moment to inflict its wrath when commanded. She shuddered again and pinned it to her shirt. She fled the carnage, pausing only to collect the belongings that had been taken from her. She and the horse galloped away, disappearing as they went. If Imerez was to have met them days ago, he may be nearby. It wouldn't do to be snared again, just as she was escaping. Jandara crawled to the edge of the clearing. Something like thunder and lightning crackled through her hurting head, but she was determined to stop the greenie. It wasn't revenge. She applauded the end of the miserable Garoti's life, and though there had once been friendship with Torn, he had gone sour long ago, and tolerance was all that remained. It was a directive of her lord to waylay the message, which meant waylaying the messenger. Who was this girl who could overpower men so much stronger than she? Torn, pegged to the tree with her own sword, was nothing worse than she had seen in battle, but the expression frozen on his face, an expression of utter amazement, would haunt her for some time to come. Jen was amazed herself. Who would have thought the girl capable, and the brand on torn skin? Exactly who were they dealing with? Jandara's dagger shone dully in the moonlight as she reached the edge of the road. With the throbbing in her head, standing was impossible. Her stomach knotted in nausea. She caught a flurry of movement on the road and the pounding of hooves. She watched the girl and the horse leave at a gallop, then fade out into nothingness. Jandara curled up on the ground, resting her head on her arm. What were they dealing with? Way Station. They galloped through the night, the horse's hooves echoing dully on the road. The gray world passed as a blur, and Kerrigan relied on the horse to find the way. Holding on to his mane and keeping her seat was all she could manage under the weight of invisibility. When the night changed to a lighter shade of gray, the horse slowed to a walk and halted. What? Kerrigan was unable to lift her head from his warm neck. The horse glanced both ways up and down the road, then, with a swish of his tail, he stepped into the woods. No path existed here, not even a deer trail. Yet as they passed through the woods, no underbrush or low-hanging branches snagged them, and the ground was clear and level. The horse skirted a granite outcropping, and something snapped within Kerrigan. The world repainted itself in the colors of early dawn, and the weight of invisibility lifted from her and raised her spirits. Snug against a granite ledge, a tiny log cabin with a fenced paddock and attached lean-to shelter came into view. She was nearly on top of it before she saw it. There was no sign of life anywhere near the cabin except the morning song of birds. "What is this place?" Kerrigan asked the horse. She dismounted, falling to her knees in fatigue. He nuzzled her shoulder reassuringly. The brooch had sapped Kerrigan's energy painfully, and it was some time before she could stand again, and even then she had to lean against the horse for support as they walked to the cabin. A winged horse was carved on the door. "Is this a Green Rider shelter?" she asked. The horse whickered and nudged her back. She unlatched the door and stumbled inside. The one-room cabin was musty from lack of use, and dust swirled about her boots with each step she took. Green Riders probably didn't travel this way often. The interior was cloaked in darkness, with the shutters fastened closed, but she had reclaimed her moonstone along with her other belongings, and now used it to light the building. Silver light stretched to all corners of the cabin and lifted some of her fatigue and heartened her, as if to remind her that she was truly alive. A straw mattress lay on a simple bed frame against the far wall. A shelf above held some candles, a lamp, and even a few books. Wood was stacked next to a stone fireplace with snowshoes propped on the mantel. More shelves held jars sealed with wax and cork. A cedar-lined closet contained blankets, pillows, and some clothing. Kerrigan tore off her own shirt, stained with Garoti's tobacco juice, and now she saw in the light flecks of blood. Throwing it to the floor, she grabbed a white linen shirt from the closet and pulled it over her head. Then she pinned the brooch on. She felt less dirty now, having broken one more thread that had bound her to the mercenaries. She took some bedclothes from the closet and heaped them on the table. Using what little strength she possessed, she beat on the mattress, raising all manner of dust. She staggered out of the cabin, sneezing. The horse watched her expectantly, his ears at point. When the fit passed, Kerrigan untacked him. "Sorry I made you wait, horse," she said. Her father and her riding master had both insisted that the horse that bore you must be seen to before yourself. She should have taken care of him before investigating the cabin. After all, he had carried her through the night for who knew how many miles, while she had clung to him witless under the spell of the brooch. He deserved her consideration, at the very least. Once untacked, the horse walked into the paddock and under the roof of the shelter. Again, he watched her expectantly. Kerrigan followed and gazed about. A large bin containing a stash of grain and two buckets was attached to one of the walls. The grain appeared, if not fresh, unspoiled. No beetles or worms crawled in it. She scooped some of the sweet-smelling grain into one bucket, then took the other in search of water. She did not have to go very far. A spring bubbled behind the shelter, trickling into a stream that ran down an embankment. She drank of the clear, cold water, unclogging her throat of road and cabin dust, then filled the bucket and took it to the horse. With those tasks accomplished, she returned to the cabin, wrapped a blanket around herself, and fell to the bed. She was asleep in an instant. Kerrigan awoke with a shiver. Her breath fogged in the cool, damp air. Not at all unusual in a northern spring, but not altogether pleasant. At first, she thought it was the same morning as that of her arrival, but this morning was drizzly, whereas yesterday had promised warmth and sun. With the blanket still wrapped around her, she found a tinderbox on the fireplace mantel, opened the flue of the chimney, and stacked wood on the hearth for a cheerful blaze. It wasn't long before the cabin filled with warmth. She traded the blanket for her greatcoat and stepped outside to see the horse. She refilled his grain and water buckets, the pure ordinariness of the activity creating a sense of security that she hadn't felt for ages. Maybe she could stay hidden in this place and let the world continue without her. The scent of wood smoke lured her back into the cabin. She had filled a kettle with spring water and now set it over the fire. It had been days since Jindara had let her bathe in a muddy stream, and her fastidious nature insisted upon bathing as a priority that morning. As she waited for the water to heat up, she searched the shelves again. The jars contained tea, spices, soap, and ointment, as well as an assortment of mismatched crockery. Kerrigan gleefully sprinkled tea leaves into a crude mug and anticipated the boiling of the water. She espied her old, stained shirt out of the corner of her eye where she had dropped it on the floor the previous morning. With a grim smile, she pinched a corner of the fabric between her fingers and tossed it into the fire. The rest of her clothes, except a pair of blue trousers, had been left by the roadside miles ago, deemed worthless by Jindara and Torn. On impulse, she inspected the closet again, the scent of cedar hanging heavy and cloying in the little cabin. Within, she found more linen shirts, but only one fit reasonably well. Each shirt bore a winged horse embroidered in gold on the sleeve. Kerrigan glanced at her own sleeve, and sure enough, found a winged horse. Soft hide trousers dyed in green, fur-lined greatcoats and cloaks, tall black boots, and mittens and gloves filled the closet, but only one pair of trousers fit her. She pulled out a pair of leather gloves with flaring cuffs over her hands, and liked the effect. The cuffs would hide the burns on her wrists. "Well," she said, "everyone thinks I'm a green rider, so I may as well dress like one." Everything in the closet was new and unused, and a notice tacked to the closet door requested that all items removed be reported to the quartermaster for restocking purposes. It was one more thing she would have to take care of when she reached Sacker City, if she made it. When the water boiled, Kerrigan brewed some tea and set about washing herself with a cloth and honey soap. Gritting her teeth, she pried the dirt-caked dressings from her wrists. They stuck stubbornly to her skin, and the scabs broke as she pulled. Her wrists were chafed, tender, sore and oozing, but not festering. The care of the Elysians had surpassed anything the menders in Selium could have done. She cleaned the burns, applied ointment, and dressed them with fresh bandage strips she had found in the cabinet. A look in a dusty mirror revealed yellowing bruises on her face. She averted her gaze. Garrote's assault, all too fresh in her mind. Her stomach rumbled, and only now did she think about food. Though Torn, Jindara, and Garoti had dented her food stores, there was still some hard bread, cheese, and dried meat left in the saddlebags. Further digging revealed two wrinkly apples. Kerrigan sat down for a feast by the crackling fire, as the warmth of the tea spread throughout her body. It was late afternoon by the time Kerrigan realized she had dozed off. She stretched muscles cramped by the wooden chair and threw a new log on the fading embers of the fire. Then she looked over the cabin's supply of books, which included the fictional story, The Journeys of Gillen Willowland. Kerrigan had read and reread it long ago, though fiction books were hard to come by. Her mother had spotted it at a fair and added it to the tiny Glavian library. As a child, Kerrigan had pretended she was Gillen's sidekick, Blaine, traveling lands that existed only in the author's imagination. She had trooped around her father's estate, brandishing a stick as her sword, and tormented the house cat as if he were the murderous dragon, Villaflavo. The offended Tom was named Dragon as a result. Now Kerrigan was experiencing her own adventure, but it wasn't anything like the journeys of Gillen Willowland. The danger was far too real and unpleasant. Gillen and Blaine had ridden through adventure after adventure nearly unscathed. Kerrigan could not say the same. Another book titled The Natural History of the Northern Wilderness had also been on the shelf of Master Ione's classroom. What possible use Green Riders would have for it, she couldn't imagine. It did not occur to her that at least one among them was interested in the wildflowers, birds, or mammals of the region. Surely Green Riders were far too busy to worry about nature. The third and last book was bound in plain leather. It was some sort of journal. Inside, a variety of handwriting styles were scrawled across the pages, some legible, some not. She sat by the fire, absorbed by the entries.
"Arrived at North Way Station by dusk," wrote Perry Mantobe. "Snowshoes a must. Blizzard dropping inches more of snow as I write. I'm not sure I will even be able to reach the horse."
Kerrigan gazed sideways at the snowshoes on the mantel. The entry was over 10 years old. Some nameless rider wrote in another entry. "Saw a pileated woodpecker by the stream, bear tracks in the mud of the spring. Several songbirds I couldn't identify greeted me this morning." Kerrigan held the book to her chest. Bears. She hadn't even thought about them. After all her adventures thus far, they didn't seem like much of a threat by comparison. An entry by T. Bankside read,
"Chased by brigands all the way from north. Lieutenant Mapstone's knife wound festering badly. She's burning with fever. Don't know if she'll live the night."
Kerrigan flipped the page, but the chronicler failed to mention whether or not the lieutenant had survived. She read until dusk. Many of the entries were no more than accounts of the weather and local fauna. Some entries were set in poetry, while others were accompanied by illustrations. By the time she finished the book, she was under the impression that Green Riders were a colorful group. Kerrigan left the warmth of the cabin to check on the horse. He trotted up to the gate of the enclosure and whickered in greeting. Despite the damp weather, he seemed in good spirits.
"You deserve a break, don't you?" she said.
After she fed and watered him, she turned to walk back to the cabin, and walked right into a big man. She screamed and fell back, wishing herself invisible. The man was massive, even taller than her father, with enough heft to make him appear as broad as he was tall. His face was a tangle of curly gray whiskers that hung from his face like lichen draped over spruce branches. Black eyes pierced beneath bushy brows. He was dressed in drab brown and gray, and a huge axe hung from his belt. He was a troll come to life. He rotated slowly around as if trying to see where she went.
"Green Rider?"
The voice was surprisingly gentle.
"I didn't mean to frighten you. Please come back. I smelled the wood smoke and wanted to make sure all was well."
The horse gave the giant little more than a cursory glance before sticking his nose into the grain bucket. The weight of invisibility wore on Kerrigan, chafing against her like an old wound.
"Who are you?"
she asked, not willing just yet to reveal herself.
The man turned in the direction of her voice, but looked through her.
I am Abram Rust, King's Forester.
He moved aside his damp cloak and revealed the emblem of an evergreen embroidered on his leather vest.
I mean no harm.
Kerrigan dropped the invisibility and staggered against a fence post.
You really shouldn't use your magic here,
the man said, his tone matter-of-fact. Kerrigan's eyes widened. Was she the last person in all of Secaridia to know that people still used magic?
Those who built this way station wanted to ensure it remained hidden. They set spells around the area, strong old spells, I'll wager. When you use your own magic, it conflicts.
Kerrigan raised a brow. How do you know all this?
I've known a great many Green Riders, and they've told me things. You look pale. Won't you let me help you back inside?
Kerrigan clung fiercely to the fence post as he stretched out a bear paw of a hand.
Let me tell you, Forrester, I've killed an evil creature from Canmeran Vane, a mercenary, and a swordmaster.
The latter claim was somewhat dubious. It had been free in Kobolbay, using her body, who had defeated Torn, but it would serve to impress the giant. He nodded solemnly.
I'm sure you've done a great many things, even as young as you are. Perhaps you can tell me of your adventures. It's been a while since a Green Rider has passed this way. Please, let me help you in. I promise I won't harm you.
Abram's quiet voice was sincere. Fine, Kerrigan said.
But I won't put up with anything. You make a wrong move, and I can't promise you'll live through the night.
She wasn't sure, but Abram might have been smiling. It was hard to tell with all his whiskers, but crinkles deepened beneath his eyes. She took his hand and allowed herself to be led into the cabin. Assured that Kerrigan was comfortably propped on the bed, Abram Rust sat in the chair by the fire. The chair creaked as if it might fall to pieces under his weight, but it held. Abram's bulk crowded the cabin. Silence reigned as he gazed about speculatively, every movement deliberate, as if he thought it out before he did it, even the blinking of his eyes.
This cabin does not change, but the riders do.
His bass voice startled Kerrigan.
Rarely do I see the same two riders pass through here.
His whiskers drooped. Why is that?
They move on to other routes or other jobs. Many die. I visit the cabin when a rider is present to seek news. Often they tell me that a previous occupant has died in the line of duty.
Kerrigan could believe it.
How long have you been coming here?
He chuckled. It was a low, throaty sound.
Years beyond count, young one. I've been roaming these woods long before the riders decided to put a way station here. I've roamed these woods before Zachary became king, even before his grandmother ruled. I've seen seedlings grow into mighty trees, then burn to the ground, only to start the cycle anew. Through all the changes, I am still Forrester. I protect my domain as well as I can, though evermore it is threatened.
Threatened? Kerrigan looked around the cabin as if brigands would break through the rough-hewn log walls.
The mills. The need to clear land to farm and settle. The need to build fleets of ships to sail the seas, and the need to warm homes during our savage winters.
Abram leaned toward her, his features earnest.
There is even a growing need for paper these days. Acres of forest around here have been toppled. So far, this has been outside my domain, but they do not replant and carve ever deeper into the forest.
But surely your job is to cut trees.
Kerrigan looked at his axe meaningfully.
You are correct, but this is King's land. I'm the guardian of Zachary's forests here, as I have been for three generations of his family. I'm selective in my cutting. A few white pines here for shipmasts, a few cedars there for shingles, and I always replant. As other forest is laid waste, my axe is used more to defend the boundaries of my domain. The folk of North are ever pressuring King Zachary to open his lands to lumbering. Some attempt it without seeking permission.
This North is a lumber town?
Mostly.
Abram pulled out a pipe and tobacco pouch from his cloak. He stuffed the pipe with tobacco and drew a flame on some kindling from the fire and lit it.
It began as a small settlement about 100 years back, but with all the demands for timber nowadays, the population swelled.
Abram blew smoke rings toward the ceiling, an amused twinkle in his eyes. When the rings dissipated, the twinkle faded.
North is a lawless town now. Most of the folk descended from the original settlers left, sold their claims. Some stayed to see what wealth they could make themselves. Others opened mercantiles and inns. The fur trade is growing too, and now I must protect the creatures within my domain as well as the trees.
I've never heard of North. Or had she? Something the Barry sisters had said nagged at the back of her mind.
This must be a new route for you,
Abram said.
Or maybe you were just new.
Kerrigan grimaced. I'm not really a Green Rider.
Abram stood up, his head brushing the rafters. His hand went to the haft of his axe.
How can this be?
His eyes glinted dangerously. He was like a rearing bear, bristling, wrathful, and immense. His presence overpowered the room. Frightened by this sudden transformation, Kerrigan tried to fade out again, but pain lanced through her head. The effort was too much.
Who are you?
Abram demanded.
You dress like a Green Rider and use Green Rider magic. Who are you?
I'm Kerrigan Glathian. I'm finishing a mission for a dead Green Rider.
Abram looked at her askance, then let his hand drop from the axe to his side.
It sounds an interesting story. Tell me, and I will decide.
He sat again, but rigidly, his eyes still suspicious. Kerrigan started with her flight from Selium and finished with her arrival to the waystation.
I'm not a Green Rider, she said, but I'm helping one.
Abram's eyes softened considerably, and he relaxed in his chair.
A long journey you've had. A brave one. I met Free in Cobble Bay once. About 2 years ago, he passed through my domain. A lively lad, very cheerful. I'm sorry to hear of his demise. I understand now how I mistook you for a rider. I did think you young, though I know they will accept young people.
I must reach Saka City before the Moellians find me again.
Abram muttered something under his breath. It sounded more like a growl, and tapped his fingers on the flat of the axe head. Smoke rings drifted to the rafters one after the other.
Strange things certainly have been happening. King's men have been in the region of late, hunting out ground mites. So, I understand. But a breach in the dire war? That bodes evil. Mournhaven the Black perverted the trees of Blackvale, and they've never recovered.
So the Elysian told me.
Abram's eyes brightened.
I'd hand over my axe to meet an Elysian. I knew in my heart they weren't legend. A sylvan folk they are. Dwellers of the Elkwood, just as I'm a dweller of this forest. And to think they were wandering through Sacaridia's green cloak. It's an honor.
Kerrigan pulled the moonstone from her pocket, certain that Abram would like to see it. The shadows of evening vanished in silver light, bringing to mind dancers in a forest clearing and moonstones glimmering on evergreen boughs. Abram's eyes opened wide.
What is it?
A moonstone. A real moonstone.
Now that I thought a legend. The Elysians gave it to you?
No. The Barry sisters I told you about. They gave it to me.
She explained the professor's predilection for magical artifacts.
A most unusual hobby,
Abram said.
Kerrigan didn't hear him. Whatever it was the sisters had said about North, it was nagging her again. And then, like a bright flash of sunlight, it came to her. East by North, they had said. East by North. Kerrigan sat up straight.
What is it?
Abram asked.
I told them I didn't know how to get to Sacker City, and they said to go east by north.
She had a sudden urge to giggle. When they had first told her to go east by north, she had thought it pure nonsense.
That would make sense.
Abram puffed on his pipe, as if she had said nothing unusual.
The road ends in north. To reach Sacker City, you must travel east, and then south. If you were traveling from Selium, you certainly went out of your way.
The horse refused to put one hoof on the Kingway.
Yes, messenger horses are a strange breed, a trifle uncanny. They've more common sense than most.
I need to get to Sacra City. I suppose that means going through north.
Yes, but you best do so with utmost caution,
Abram said.
As I said, north is lawless and wild, and these are strange times with strange folk traveling. Why, you've already met up with brigands. I avoid north myself.
What kind of strange folk? Kerrigan wanted to know. You can find brigands anywhere, even in Selium.
There is a woman from Rovni, an exile, stirring up trouble, wants to rid all the lands of monarchs and let the people rule.
Abram stroked his beard thoughtfully.
Anarchy, I call it. Yet there are many who follow her and believe the rumors of new taxes on lumbering. Supposedly the taxes will go toward fortifying Sacra City and the royal house. Folks tied up in the paper and shipbuilding trades are infuriated. Other rumors circulate. The king turned down a proposal to marry a princess of the Cloud Islands, which would have fostered a profitable alliance. Now the queen of the islands is insulted and may refuse to trade with Sacaridia altogether. The Cloud Islands bring fruit, spices, and whale oil. It is said that King Zachary still believes the old magic should be put into use again. Most folks believe that using magic will summon the evil of Mournhaven the Black. When you go to north, you must be quiet about the abilities of your brooch. The least magic will provoke suspicion.
One can only hope these rumors are isolated. Kerrigan knew they would not be, however. Her own father was suspicious of anything remotely related to magic.
If rumors are to be believed, there have already been assassination attempts on King Zachary. Others are calling for his brother to take the throne.
Jandara's rightful king was Zachary's brother, she was sure, and would explain the Swordmaster's devotion as a weapon. But what did Mirwell have to do with it?
North is not friendly to representatives of the king, or would-be representatives.
Abram thrust the poker at the logs on the fire. A flurry of sparks shot up the chimney.
As I said, I won't go there myself. Already I've been accused of being a forestry regulator.
Is there any way to go around north? Abram shook his head.
If you travel east or south from here, the River Terrigood lies in your path. At this time of the year, its current runs strong and deadly. Should you attempt to ford it, even your big horse would be swept away like a leaf in a whirlpool. At midsummer or later, you might ford it, but not now. The only bridge is in north.
Kerrigan sagged against her pillow. Is there any good news?
There is. I will lead you through the woods to a point on the north road, not far from town. In the woods, I can ensure your safety.
Kerrigan nodded. That sounds encouraging. What about town itself? Abram grimaced, or at least his whiskers drooped.
I will not go upon the road which is beyond my boundaries. You must travel the rest of the way yourself. You should reach town by evening, and will probably wish to stay the night. Not the best of circumstances, but I know of a respectable inn that caters to the few merchants who travel this way. It is called the Fallen Tree. It is costly, but worth it. Avoid all others. When you leave north, you will find on the other end of town there is a horse track leading east and then south. It will take you part way to Sacra City. The rest will be through open countryside.
Kerrigan tucked her knees up to her body and wrapped her arms around them. It was beginning to sound like she was nearing the end of her journey, and she grinned. Thank you, Abram. It won't be long now before I give King Zachary his message.
Do not let your guard down, no matter how near the king's castle you are,
Abram cautioned.
It will be easy to do so, with this as the last leg of your journey. Be watchful.
I promise.
Good.
Abram tapped his pipe against the fireplace.
Then on to more pleasant topics. You told me of your adventures, so now I will tell you some of my tales.
Abram spoke long into the night. His stories took shape slowly and deliberately.
his voice low and melodious. He told stories of other Green Riders who had passed through his domain.
Disaster seemed to follow young Mayer like a crow. The shelf would fall down when he placed a book on it, or he'd trip out the door. One night he accidentally kicked a bucket of ashes on the floor and nearly set the cabin on fire.
Abram pointed to a charred spot on the floor near the fireplace.
Disaster helped him on one ride, however. He was in Afton Village, which is in Coutray Province, during market. He fell right off his horse onto a fruit stand. The woman tending it, the daughter of a wealthy farmer, married him. Mayer no longer carries messages on dangerous rides, but tends blueberry barrens on his own acreage.
Abram chuckled with the memory.
There was Leon, a fierce gambler by all accounts, who came from a questionable background before he joined the messenger service. He reformed many of his ways, but never the gaming spirit, and he used to sit with me before this very fire, trying to swindle the last copper from me. More often than not, he succeeded, until the very last game. And there was Evany with her beautiful voice, who should have been at Selium for music instead of wearing the colors of the Green Riders.
He shook his head sadly.
She was killed by a noble, angered by the message she bore.
Abram's story spanned more than 50 years, slowly unfolding the heritage of the Green Riders. He remembered the name of every rider he met, along with some small detail. "Will you remember me?" Kerrigan asked.
"Indeed I will. In you I see the spirit of the first rider. She who carried the messages when Sacheridia was newly created. Even your name speaks of ancient times. Galathian, it would have been pronounced in the old days, not much different than today. Its meaning, however, is beyond my knowledge. I expect to hear more about you in the years to come, young Kerrigan. This mission of yours is just a beginning."
"I just want it to be over with." Abram shook his head.
"Green Riders are always in haste. Do you know there is a legend that, during the Long War, the messenger horses of the Saka clans could fly? Your big red doesn't look likely to sprout wings, so I don't take the legend literally. Perhaps the horses were extraordinarily swift. Who's to say? The old days were odd and rife with magic. I imagine the legend is what inspired the winged horse insignia of the Green Riders."
Abram told tales in his melodious voice until Kerrigan couldn't keep her eyes open. Vaguely, she was aware of him pulling a blanket up to her shoulders and leaving, as if in a cloud of smoke, the scent of tobacco lingering behind. Green Riders trampled through Kerrigan's dreams. They galloped along wooded trails. Horse hooves thundered over wooden bridges. A horse and rider surged up a mountain slope, slipping and staggering on loose gravel and sand. A toothy range of snow-capped purple mountains loomed behind them. A messenger cantered her horse along the shore, and hooves splashed through ocean waves and sent up cascades of salty spray. The rider laughed in pure joy. Another Green Rider rode down a cobbled city street, face grim and saber bare. The throb of hooves grew like a heartbeat. Kerrigan sat astride the horse, kicking up snow as they galloped through some winter scene. The sound of hoofbeats merged into great wingbeats as the horse sprouted white feathered wings and flew up above the snow, above the woods and mountains, through the blue of the sky, and higher yet among the stars. Here they flew among the immortals of the heavens, past the Sword of Sevelon, past the Hunter's Belt, past the throne of Kandor the Great, and Eric and Orion smiled on them. In time, they descended from the stars and glided through the dark of night, through the canopy of the forest to the floor. The greens and browns of the woods were intensely deep, as if damp. The beat still carried the dream, but this time it was not hooves or wings, but Abram Rust swinging his axe against the trunk of a great white pine. When he stopped, an echo continued the pulsing rhythm. He mopped his brow of sweat and turned to her.
"This tree will make the mast of a ship that will carry you through the ages."
A winged horse was carved into the trunk. Abram Rust laughed, and with one more mighty blow, the tree crashed to its side, leaving a gaping hole in the canopy to the sky. The night was coated with stars, like a sprinkling of sugar. Then, the dreams dissipated, like pipe smoke. Gray One.
"I've seen nothing like that," the blacksmith snapped. "You had best move on. Folks here don't take kindly to your type."
Joy Overway watched in resignation as the blacksmith disappeared into the hazy dark of his shop. His was the same response she had received all day. She wondered if the good citizens of North would honestly tell her if they had seen Freyan's horse or the girl. Not without a hefty bribe, no doubt. She carried just enough currency to get her to Selium, then back to Sacker City, with none left over for bribes. Alas, she didn't possess Captain Mapstone's talent for seeing the truth in a person's words. The most forthcoming citizen had been a fortune-teller in one of the inns. Joy frowned. The woman had predicted ominous and mysterious things, and had placed on the table a fortune card of a messenger fleeing arrows. "What's this?" she had asked. The fortune-teller leaned forward, her eyes wide.
"You will not find what you seek if you stay on your present course," she whispered. "If you do continue down this path, your footsteps will lead you to disaster."
Joy had left in disgust. More time wasted. The fortune-teller hadn't even bothered to concoct a prediction as to where Freyan's horse was, or where she might locate the girl. Just these vague, titillating warnings that were the common practice for the fortune-telling trade, used to draw the unsuspecting in to spend more currency for more fabricated prognostications. Strange part was, the fortune-teller hadn't even hinted at a fee for the information she did provide. Joy mounted her horse and guided him down the muddy main street, which flowed between ramshackle mercantiles and a seeming overabundance of pubs, and no too few brothels among them. At this peak hour in the afternoon, these places were quiet. Much of the populace was out in the woods, felling trees. Soon enough, however, after the sunset, the town would erupt with noise, light, and life. When the river could be forded later in the season, most green riders preferred bushwhacking across the countryside, and a circuitous route rather than riding directly through North. If time was of the essence, then they might gallop through town so fast that no one was the wiser. Unfortunately, Joy's mission entailed that she make inquiries in the village itself. And she had made enough of those as far as she was concerned. The people here were incredibly hostile. She patted Red Wing's neck.
"We'll spend a peaceful night at the way station, then get as far away from this place as possible."
Red Wing bobbed his head as if in agreement. They headed south through town at a walk. Joy didn't want to give the locals the satisfaction of seeing her run. In all, it was a strange assignment she had been sent on. Perhaps it wasn't so strange for her to look for Freyan's horse, if he still carried the message. But the girl? Someone had pull with Captain Mapstone, and that particular someone had to have a lot of pull. It was not in the captain's nature to involve her messengers in non-rider affairs. Conley had sent her a very good image of the girl. Whoever sought her must have been describing her as he sent. The girl was in her late teen years, a young woman, actually, and had a well-structured face, was tall, and dressed well. An aristocrat? Conley didn't elaborate. Joy smiled. Every contact with Conley was like a gentle caress on her mind. Every night they united this intimate way, their minds touching, sending words and pictures back and forth. It helped make their separation more bearable, though it was no substitute for being together. She reined Red Wing around a group of people, the King Haters, as she had taken to calling them. The Anti-Monarchy Society was just so much hoofglop. They were spreading ill rumors about King Zachary, and the people of North fell into their cause with relish.
"You are a slave, sister,"
one of the people told her.
A kingless land is a free land. Monarchy is tyranny.
Joy urged Redwing into a canter before the king-haters could start chanting more slogans.
I wouldn't be doing this job if I didn't believe in my king, she told her horse. I'm no slave.
Once Joy was out of town, she exhaled with relief and pulled Redwing to a walk. She could feel her muscles loosen as the tension lifted from her. The road was quiet except for the chorusing of peepers in the lengthening shadows. Only one other rider headed in town. He was cloaked entirely in gray and rode at a leisurely walk. Redwing pressed his ears back against his neck.
What is it? She asked him.
Redwing snorted and sidestepped as the rider drew abreast of them. The man was cloaked and hooded, and she couldn't tell anything about him, except for a tendril of gold hair that escaped his hood. He drew his horse to a halt. Joy nodded to him and rode on by. He did not speak to her or even acknowledge her, and she was glad. Something about him made the back of her neck twinge. She glanced over her shoulder to see if he had ridden on. He hadn't. He was following her. He drew a black arrow from his quiver and knocked it to his bow.
Oh, gods, she whispered.
Conley had told her how Freyan died. Two black arrows in his back. She had only to touch Redwing to send him flying into a gallop. She veered off the road, crouching low in the saddle. There was nowhere to hide, though. The woods were clear-cut. Redwing stretched his legs down slope, where a boggy pond was rimmed with a thicket of trees. In the trees, bow and arrow would be next to useless. The gray rider's horse pounded after her, his hoofbeats like an echo of Redwing's. The gray rider drew abreast of her, even over the uncertain ground, plunging over snags of wood and across slippery granite. The gray rider dropped his reins, guiding his horse with the touch of his legs and knees. He drew his bowstring, and an arrow sang. Redwing stumbled beneath Joy, fell away like her own footing lost. She rolled clear as he tumbled haunches overhead, the air thick with his screams, his hooves flailing up toward the sky. Then he stilled. Dust drifted and settled about him, where he lay dead, an arrow in his throat. Joy hauled herself behind him, face wet with tears, and grief jammed like a fist in her throat. Her leg was twisted at the wrong angle, her thigh bone protruding through ragged muscle and skin like an ivory bull's horn. She could not feel it, but darkness hovered at the edges of her mind. She drew her saber, though it would be no defense against arrows. The gray rider sat still and silent on his steed. He knocked another arrow and aimed it at her. She heard whispers issue from his hood, as if he spoke invocations over the arrow, or maybe it was the gods calling her. Pain exploded in Joy's chest.
Conley, she croaked.
The world became gauzy around her, and she could feel life leaking away and a darkness spreading in her chest like a disease. The gray rider sat silhouetted on his horse. He drew out yet another arrow and knocked it to the bow. She clutched her wound and blood gouted out as if to fill her hands like cups.
Why?
She mouthed the word more than spoke it. The gray rider drew the bowstring.
You shall serve me.
His voice, she thought, was melodic. He loosed the arrow. Joy seemed to be looking at the night sky filled with bright pinpoints of stars, where the gods awaited her. She drifted, was drawn upward. Somewhere above her, vast wings fluttered. It was Westrian come to take her soul to the heavens. Cares fell away from her as she floated light and incorporeal. Then, as if a hand reached into her chest and clenched her heart, she felt pain all over again, and cold. She was wrenched earthward, against the forces of the heavens.
No! She cried. Westrian!
She was echoed by an angry screech. The flutter of wings grew more distant and soon vanished.
You shall serve me,
the melodic voice said.
Joy's feet were planted on the ground. She looked skyward, but the starry night was gone, and the air was hazy gray and dull, lifeless. The arrows projected from her chest like porcupine quills, and she tried to pull them out, but only enveloped herself with pain.
They mark you as mine. Think of them as your collar, slave.
The gray rider still sat upon his horse, but he was no longer gray. His cloak and hood shimmered with the colors of the rainbow, and he almost looked as if he sat upon the air, for his horse blended in with the gray and lifeless world. Her corpse and Red Wing's lay insubstantial, ghostly. Her body was splayed and broken. Her blood had saturated her shirt and coat with darkness. It was not red in her vision. Only the winged horse brooch had any color. It blossomed with a cold golden gleam. She reached for it, but her hand passed through her body. She looked at her hands. They were flesh-colored. They flexed open and closed into fists. They seemed alive. Was this what it was like to be a ghost? The living world became dead?
Joy.
Joy looked behind her, and there stood Freean Kobolbay, more real than anything in the midst of the gray world. His green uniform was almost vibrant.
Take my hand, he said.
He stretched his gloved hand toward her. Behind him stood a host of green riders dressed in uniforms from centuries gone by. They whispered and shifted like shadows. Take his hand, they whispered to her. Red Wing stood there with him, his mane and tail flowing in no natural wind. Joy reached for him. The pain constricted around her chest. The darkness spread.
Come, Freean said. You are one of us.
What has happened? She gasped.
This is a between place, Freean said. The Shadow Man keeps us from going beyond. His arrows, they are anchors. Take my hand.
Take his hand, the others whispered.
Do not listen, the Grey Rider said, or you will be tormented forever by pain. It would be worse than any hell wrought by your mythologies. Take my hand, Freean said.
Joy fought the pain, her fingers touching his. They were warm, felt like real flesh. He grasped her hand and held it. The arrows seared her chest. If she went to the Grey Rider, she would be relieved of the pain. But it was not right for her to join him. North. Kerrigan awoke with the echo of hoofbeats fading with her dreams, and all but forgotten as she attacked her morning tasks. The horse was promptly fed, watered, and rubbed down. Breakfast was prepared and eaten with dispatch. She took up a broom which had stood hidden in a dark corner and swept the cabin thoroughly. She checked her packs to make sure all was in order. She found Freean Kobolbay's love letter to Lady Astora in the message satchel. Maybe Torn and Jindara had thought any document was valuable, and so saved it. Certainly they weren't being sentimental. Kerrigan herself had forgotten all about it. The important thing was that the message to King Zachary was still intact, the seal unbroken. As she folded and returned the bedclothes to the cedar closet, she espied a tongue of leather sticking out between some blankets. It was a sword belt and scabbard. A sword belt would make it more difficult to separate her from the saber. It was a loose fit, even when buckled on the last hole, but it would do. She tucked the excess leather beneath the belt and sheathed the saber into the plain black scabbard. In an effort not to look so much like a green rider in a town that would not welcome one, she dressed in her own blue trousers and rolled up the sleeves of her new linen shirt to hide the insignia. It was warm enough anyway. She tied the greatcoat around the bedroll, but the brooch remained pinned to her shirt. It wasn't supposed to identify one as a green rider anyway, except to another green rider. It stood to reason that the tack might give her away, but she hoped nobody would look close enough to notice. She took one last glance around the cabin and sighed. The stories it could tell. I suppose I heard most of them last night from Abram. Gathering up the tack and packs, Kerrigan stepped outside into sunshine. Reluctantly, she latched the door behind her and walked to the paddock, the saber slapping awkwardly against her thigh. The path was still moist from the previous day's rain, and the air was heavy with the smells of evergreen and bayberry, drying in the sun.
Bayberry?
She stopped in her tracks. There hadn't been a bayberry bush next to the path yesterday.
Had there?
But there it was, next to a patch of bunchberry flowers.
I don't believe it.
Each bunchberry flower was perfect, except for one, missing a petal. She plucked it and twirled it in front of her eyes.
Could it be?
She slipped it into her pocket and snapped off a bayberry branch, just in case. Abram awaited her in the paddock, patting the horse on his neck.
Good morning, he said. Your guide awaits you.
Kerrigan returned his greeting with a grin. She set the saddle on the paddock fence and slipped the bridle over the horse's head.
I appreciate this. The Mruwellians won't find me in the forest.
Abram returned her smile, then helped her place the saddle on the horse's back.
That is correct.
Abram insisted that she ride the horse, though he would be on foot. He claimed his long legs could keep up with any steed. Kerrigan pulled the girth tight, hoisted up her sagging sword belt, and mounted. Abram led them out of the paddock, the horse's hooves sinking into the mud. Kerrigan ducked beneath tree limbs laden with water from the previous day's rain, but still managed to get drenched. Biders clouded in the shade, their numbers beginning to wane as the season progressed. Sun filtered through the trees and turned droplets clinging to spider webs into lacy jewels. Fiddleheads unfurled into broad cinnamon ferns, and the leaves of aspen, birch, and maple trees fully budded, blotting out the sky more than ever. Abram guided her along no visible trail. He skirted granite ledges and winter blowdowns, stepping across gurgling streams that would dry out by summer's end, and wove his way through patches of brush. Whatever path he followed, it was easy to travel. He hummed the entire way, his beard bristling as if he were smiling. Kerrigan wondered at his content, and was surprised he did not smoke. When she remarked upon this, he replied,
I need no smoke here. Into the cities and villages by the side of a fire. That is where I need it.
They spoke little as they traveled, though they stopped periodically so Abram could show Kerrigan delicate lady slippers, bluets, and trillium, his huge hands dwarfing the blossoms. The sun changed the shapes of shadows in the woods and lifted a moist vapor from the damp ground. Pine needles scattered on the forest floor dried in the sun and left a strong tang of balsam in the air. Somewhere, a woodpecker could be heard tapping on a tree. Abram stopped and looked up. Kerrigan followed his gaze and beheld the tallest white pine she had ever seen. Its girth was so wide that even Abram couldn't wrap his arms all the way around it.
This tree is hundreds of years old, he said. I never fail to be awed by it. See up the trunk? The scar that looks like the shape of a gull in flight?
She squinted, barely able to discern crude wings and a body cut into the bark. The scar was dark, an old carving. Who would bother to do such a thing? She was familiar with the carvings made by lovers, but who would carve a gull into the trunk of a tree in the middle of the wilderness?
One who was a forester long before me.
But why do it in the first place? Carving initials into a tree was a silly way to express love. Love was a bit silly anyway, but it was also cruel if the love ended. Abram slapped the tree trunk with his palm, as if meeting an old friend.
This was a king's tree, young one, marked to one day be the mast of some great sailing vessel. The mark is that of Clan Sealander.
Sealander? Kerrigan furrowed her brow. It was a new clan name to her.
The bloodline that ruled Sacaridia before Hillander, when Sealander died out. Hillander battled for and won the right of succession. Both are descended from the original Saka clans.
Oh.
Once again, Kerrigan had been stumped by what was probably common knowledge.